You are listening to Grandpa Lampshade.
Check. Vape check. Number 49 installment of the Church of the Lampshade show. Check. That's right. It's that time. Believe it or not, it's already Tuesday and another fun-filled adventure lies ahead. That's right. The church right here. You don't even have to leave wherever you're at. You just tune in. And you know a fun-filled adventure lies in wait. Thank you for joining us this week. We've got we're going to have another completely packed show. If this keeps up, we're just going to have to officially extend the show and make it longer because we're going to have so much content to cover. Or we're going to have to split it up and do two shows in a week. I don't know which it would be, but we're going to try to cram it all in. We will cram it all in. We're going to do something a little different when we do our sermon this week, or Christian-specific message this week. We're going to do something a little different. We're going to rock some Old Testament, which is going to be fun. Trust me. Don't get triggered. Don't sit here and think, but it says Israel and my Jews. That's not, don't worry. We can rock the Old Testament and still have a good time. We've got seven supporters this week. Want to sincerely extend my appreciation, including one Bitcoin Anon. Remember, if you want in on that action, and I highly encourage you to do so, the information's at the bottom of the description page. We've got snail mail, we've got Bitcoin, we've got just about any other kind of crypto you might want to imagine. If you've got some weirdo like Ox or Zcash or whatever that you'd like to send, drop me an email. I'll get you an address for that. Most people, they're doing good to manage Bitcoin. But hey, you know, we will accommodate you as far as your shekels. As far as your shekels. Anyway, we can. Trust me. Trust me. Yeah, we got seven sponsors this week. And that means we've got listener mailbag. And, also at the bottom of the page, we do have an email there if you're a Bitcoin or crypto sponsor. You know, hey, drop me an email. Be glad to give you some recognition. Highly encourage you to do that. I'd like to recognize those who are putting forth the effort to keep the show going. Also, your questions, comments, just in general, are welcome as well. So, yeah, we got to get quick and get straight into the supporter mailbag because, like I said, we got a lot of fun stuff to talk about this week. I think I'm excited. Well, I'm excited every week. But I'm especially excited this week because I think it's going to be I think we're going to talk about some really interesting stuff. Let's get to this, to the supporter mailbag. Sarah, always enjoy your content. Best wishes. Very much appreciate it. And by the way, you have very pretty handwriting. You know, it's a lost art, and my handwriting is like scribbles. And yes, I'm old enough. I have the art of the cursive. It doesn't matter if I print, if I cursive, it's like a code. It's like a code. You can't even read my stuff. Sometimes it's so bad. Sometimes I make a note and I go back and look and I can't even read. I can't even read my own stuff. It's like, what in the world was I saying there? I just sitting there scratching my head. So yeah, you know, having pretty handwriting is actually a pretty cool thing for those of us who don't. Other supporters, Sticker Guy, always good to hear from Sticker Guy. He puts these up everywhere, vending machines, bulletin boards, and he contributes some here. So and they're pretty good stuff. The Goyim know. Yeah, the Goyim know. I want you to die for Israel. Good stuff. You know, and it's just, again, you can invent your own activism. It's a great example. Triangle Whip, Grandpa Lampshade, hope you had a fine Christmas. You give me enjoyment, bless you, and say hello to Savannah. So we did that just now, and very much appreciated, and that's what we're here for. We're here to, what we do here is entertainment, but it's also, you know, I think really important. I do. I think we do. This isn't just like, you know, for the commies when they tune into Colbert or something, just to hear Orange Man Bad, Orange Man Bad. What would that guy do for a show? Like if Trump dropped off the face of the earth, I mean, he has one shtick, Orange Man Bad. You know, I don't know, you know, but we actually, you know, we do more than that here. We do more than like the right wing version of that. We actually try to think about things and discuss things and give the audience something to go home, you know, and ponder about after the show is over. And next up, Jackie. Jackie gets a times two credit because we've got two letters of support this week. Very much appreciated. Grandpa Lampshade must have caught the show within an hour of it being uploaded. A fresh show. See, if it's within an hour, then it's a fresh show. Can't tell you how much I look forward to the weekly uplift on what works out to be my quote-unquote Friday. A nice way to end the wage cuck work week. Hope 2020 is going well for you and yours thus far. Appreciate it, Jackie. And yeah, you know, we're just easing on in to 2020 here, and yeah, you just never know. It's like I said before, it's just that time of the year you start thinking, you know, where am I going to be next year at this time, you know? And you know, last year at this time, no idea where I'd be this year at this time. 2019 was a tumultuous and interesting year, so yeah, no, you know, there ain't no telling. I've probably told this story again. Now I know when I was really young, we used to laugh at old people. And I'm not that old, you know, but I mean, we used to laugh at older people because the older people get, the more they repeat their stories. And I've probably told this story before, but I tell it again anyway, just because the other thing about the older you get, the less you care. But you've told that story before. I don't care. I'm telling it again. way back in ancient history. Way back in ancient history, and I think of this because, by the way, because Jackie types letters on an actual typewriter, and I thought I was the only one left on the face of the planet that knew what those are. And yes, and I have one, by the way. It's got dust on it, but I do have one. But way back in ancient history, in prehistoric times, known as the 80s, when I was in high school, like in my senior year of high school, I took typing as an elective course, aka a blow-off course, a joke course. Just, you had to take so many electives. I took typing. And back then, there weren't really guys that took typing. I think there was one or two other guys that took it for the same reason I did. And I remember, like, so we're in this typing class, and we have all these old electric typewriters. You know, they were electric, believe it or not. Wasn't that, and, you know, wasn't that long ago. But it was that electric typewriter that has that ball-looking thing that spins around. Boy, the younger people are like, I don't even know what a typewriter is. And Lampshade going on about a ball that flips around. Well, we had the electric typewriters, had the ball thing, if you're old enough to know what I'm talking about. Yeah, the ball thing that flipped around. And yeah, so we're sitting in here, and the teacher that taught the class, she was this, I don't know, she was this old lady. So she was like really old school. Like, she no doubt learned to type, like, I don't know, in the 40s or 50s, you know, and she taught the class like it was the 40s or 50s. And she was teaching a bunch of young women how, you know, how to properly sit there and be a good secretary and type, because she would walk around like with a ruler, you know, and like whack on your desk or whatever. You know, your posture is not correct. You have to have the both feet on the floor, straight back. Your hands cannot sit on the palms. She just had this. By the time we're all sitting up here, like 1950s secretaries, you know. Yes, Mr. Mason, what can I get for you? And I was good at it, though. You know, I mean, I don't know. I think when I finished that class, I was around 80 words a minute, which pretty good for me. I could go faster, but then the errors got so ridiculous. Of course, this was long before we ever dreamed of computers. And it just always funny, you know, because with the advent of the internet and obviously things we do now, and, you know, I've written and everything else, you, out of everything I took my senior year in high school, that one blow off class is the one thing that I use literally every day. I'm not somebody's secretary, but I use the typing skills every single day. It's just funny how life works out that way. So anyway, enough with the tangent. Coming up, Mr. T. Always good to hear from Mr. T. Grandpa Lampshade question. What area do you think is safer as far as a random act of violence? Are you talking about those random act of violence that are committed by men or teens? That must be what you mean. A major U.S. city or a city in Iran. I think myself and my wife could walk to a restaurant in an Iranian city and not have to worry about me being killed and her medicked. What? Like we do here. So much for progress. You know, you're exactly right. It's like that, you know, in a lot of different places too. I mean, you know, some of these countries, I remember, many years ago when that little spoiled American was, where the heck was that? Indonesia? No, somewhere. Anyway, he like vandalized a bunch of cars and got caught and they caned his ass. You remember that? And I remember people talk at the time say, yeah, in that country there, you can like drop your wallet or leave your wallet somewhere. And when you remember it, go back, it'll still be there because people think it's like a trap, like the cops laying a trap to see if you stealing that or something. No, you're absolutely right. Of course, you're probably going to be safer in Iran. And the whole Iran thing is so stupid. I get so tired of everything being this constant lie. You know, we're constantly lied to. You know, Iran. I think one of the biggest, if I read years ago, like one of the biggest synagogues in the Middle East outside of Israel is actually in Iran. So much for them running around just doing, you know, constant terrorism against the poor Jews. I mean, because they have synagogues there and they're not messing with those people. They lie to us constantly. They really do. And it gets really old. And yeah, you've got the whole demonizing Iran narrative. And you're absolutely right. You could walk to a restaurant. You could walk down the street in an Iranian city. I mean, right now you might not could because our government or the government is gone around and just, you know, constantly kicking over the anthill here. But, you know, so you might be targeted then because people are just angry and they can't strike out against the American government. So they might strike out at an American. But I get the point, and it's absolutely correct. Of course, you're going to be safer going to walking down the street in a place like Iran or any of these other places, honestly, that actually have, you know, are attempting to have somewhat sane societies. But none of that matters. What matters is, I don't know, what matters is whatever we're told this week. So appreciate it from all the listener supporters. Again, very much appreciate that. Information's at the bottom of the page. Always encourage you to do so. And real quick to the email here, listener questions, comments. This is from Charlie. Yeah, this is from Charlie, Grandpa Lampshade. My take on Iran, on the Iran situation remains unchanged by the events of last month. I consider it a dangerous, dangerous situation that we are prodding Iran into a war when Iran has alliances with both Russia and China now. Kill the wrong soldiers or hit the wrong country, and you could end up with a mess on your hands, unlike anything you could ever imagine. But I have a very good imagination. And the thing is, these people that push this stuff, they're so arrogant, they actually believe they can keep everything under control. They think that they can push this stuff so far and nothing will happen. And they're such control freaks. They think they can actually keep things from getting out of hand. I mean, and I'm not going to talk about it on this show because I think it's supposed to happen Monday. This show airs on Tuesday, but it's like this whole Virginia gun rally thing that I would not get caught within 100 miles of. You know, you've got the governor declaring a state of emergency. I mean, maybe nothing will happen, but the thing could spiral out of control. This will be hindsight by the time this show airs. So we're not, you know, like I say, it's not something on my list of things to discuss. But, you know, it's just things can get out of hand. Things can get out of hand really quickly and really easy. And thus the term out of hand means beyond your control. And yet these people that feed us the constant lies, these deep state people, government people, whatever you want to say, these politicians, those who pull the strings, I mean, they really think that they're so smart that they can keep things under control. It's impossible for things to get out of hand, or to put it another way, out of their control. And yeah, the rest of us out here living in non-clown world, yeah, we don't believe that. We think that things can very easily get out of hand, and very easily that could happen. And there's no such thing as being able to control everything. But hey, you know, we're all on the clown car. We're all along for the ride. Just enjoy the honkling. So yeah, wrapping all of that up. You know, wouldn't it be cool? I was sitting here thinking before doing the show, you know, wouldn't it be cool if like listener support and such got to the point to where like we had to extend the show to 2 hours, do the first hour just going through the listener support mailbag. And then the second hour, hey, if we had to, that's what we would do. So, you know. Anyway, always appreciate hearing from the listeners. So we got a, like I said at the opening of the show, we got a lot of we want to cover this week. So we're not going to lollygag around about it. And yeah, you know, getting into some things I've been seeing in the past week or so in the news. It, one of the things is there was this whole kvetching in the Western media about Putin. Again, imagine it's one of their favorite bad guys. Not as much of a favorite bad guy is Iran. But Putin, you know, I mean, he's probably a close second in the, second on the demonization list, you know. And, oh, Putin is rearranging the Constitution to continue to hold on to power. And I was thinking about this whole kvetching about, you know, democracy and Putin holding on to power and why this is a bad thing. And I was thinking about how nonsensical and how really the whole voting, the whole democracy thing is purposely designed for instability. Of course, in Clown World, we're lied to about everything. We're told the opposite. Democracies are stable. If the people are voting for their leaders, you are going to have a stable, wonderful society as is witnessed around us every single day. But in reality, it's really the opposite. The whole system is designed for instability. Of course, the whole system is designed so nobody gets ensconced in power except for the power brokers, big banks. I'm hand rubbing here, you know, those who contribute. You know, if you had one guy, say in America, you had one guy, let's say Trump. I know I'm just using him as an example because he's the current one in the office. But let's say Trump, you know, let's say your dreams came true and Trump really was about what so many people was hoping that he was about. And by the way, excuse me, it's another, we live in a constant bloom of cedar pollen here. So it's like every single week I fight this stuffiness. So if that comes through, I apologize in advance. It's just one of the sacrifices we make here. But not to say Trump went and, you know, he was so popular, he just basically became like president for life. Well, where's a, you know, Sheldon Adelson's power then? You know, where are these lobbyists' power? Then if the guy's president for life and isn't having to collect millions and millions of dollars to hold on to power, then where does that leave the current power brokers? It leaves them out of the loop. The notion that the democracy and the voting is designed so that the people have power. Well, certain people, the very rich, the corporations, the big banks, the usual names, the Soroses, the Adelson, there's a lot of echoing going on here. And these people have this power. It's designed for the people to have power over the politicians. True, it's just not you. You have the power of your one measly little vote. They have the power of their one measly little vote plus, oh, I don't know, $1 billion. So guess who has more power in the system? It's all a charade. It's all a joke. And it's working according to plan. I mean, this is the system we got. We work within the system. We do what we can. But let's not have any unrealistic illusions. You know, I see normie cons all the time because, as you all well know, I'm banished to the social media wasteland of Gab. And, you know, so it's like normie con central. And I mean, they're actually still hung up on this, you know, it's our fault. We keep voting for the wrong people. That's why the country's a mess. And it's like, no, the voting thing is working as designed. I mean, they're hoping that, you know, a system that's designed to do A, that is accomplishing A, is somehow all of the sudden going to start accomplishing B and C over here. And it's not what it's designed to do. It's doing what it's designed. As the saying goes, it's a feature, not a bug. But they just, they're saying it again. I mean, it's what we've got. I mean, we do what we can within the system that we have right now as we await the vibrant societal collapse. But let's not, again, let's not have any illusions that that the democracy and the voting are somehow magically going to save us in the end, because that's not how this plays out. We're just going to continue clown worlding down until the society collapses. Then we'll figure out something new, and it has to happen in that order. It has to happen in that order. People that have this, we're going to overthrow the government, and it's not going to work that way. You're not going to do that. At least I don't see it happening. You know, you just get to ride the clown car for society, you know, on the one-way trip to societal collapse. And then after the car hits the bottom of the cliff, you get to figure out, you know, who comes out of the wreckage and what do we do next. But I'm getting off, once again, I'm getting off on a tangent. Back to the Putin thing and how this is a demonstration of the design feature of instability that this voting and democracy thing is. So the Western media is kvetching about Putin's latest evil act of evil, which is basically staying in power. Now, in Russia, regardless of what you think of Putin, and look, I don't worship any man. You know, I get these people, you just worship Hitler. No, I don't worship any man. I'm a Christian believer. I don't worship any man, you know, and I don't have this rose-colored pie-in-the-sky view of Putin or anybody else. But there's no, it's just a fact that Putin has done more for Russia than anybody else in recent history. I mean, it's a fact. He's reigned. I mean, again, it's not to say they don't have their problems. Obviously, they do. But, I mean, he's reigned in the oligarchs. He's stabilized their economy. He's working towards, you know, their demographic issues, encouraging people to have more children. And that doesn't mean just importing the third world to replace the current population. They're trying to keep Russia ethnic Russian. Of course, the Russian territory covers a lot of area. There's, you know, but that's his focus. He's done a lot of good things. I mean, if you're even remotely aware of the disaster that Russia was during the 90s, during the Yeltsin the drunk Yeltsin debacle, then I mean, Putin has done an amazing job of turning the country around. And yet what? We're supposed to be concerned and kvetch and moan because the guy who's been doing a great job isn't being booted out of power and replaced by some rando? So, I mean, really, think about this. You've got somebody that's doing a great job by all, you know, result metrics. The guy's doing a great job. Why would you want to replace them? This is this idea of, oh, well, you got to replace them. Why? Because. Well, because why? Because my freedoms. And we can't have any leader becoming too powerful. Why not? If they're doing a good job. Imagine if you were running a company and your like hiring practices for your employees was that every, say, 2 years, you fired everybody and replaced them with rando people off the street. So you hire people and, you know, you've got this guy. So you've hired this guy and he's like an ace. He doesn't complain. He shows up every day, does a great job, goes home. I mean, he's like the ideal employee. And you go into his office after a couple of years and say, Jim, I just want to tell you, you've been doing an absolute fantastic. You're the best employee I've ever had. And he's like, wow, thanks, boss. Anything else I can do for you? Yes, there is something else you could do. Pack your shit and get out. What do you mean? You're fired. What do you mean I'm fired? You just got done telling me what a great job I'm doing. Yes, but you've been here 2 years. You've been here 4 years, however many years, doesn't matter. You've been here a couple years, and we get rid of everybody after 2 years. Well, who are you going to replace me with? Nobody can do this job like I can do. Well, you're probably right, but I've got this rando guy off the street. He's bringing his stuff in right now. This guy sold me a used car. I'm putting him in here to replace you. The guy's a crook. Look at him. It doesn't matter. We replace everybody after a couple of years because, you know, I can't have anybody doing, I don't know, too good a job for too long. It doesn't make any sense. It's laughable, isn't it? And yet, under the voting and democracy system, that's the very thing we're told is a good thing. You can't have anybody in there doing too good a job for too long. No, you've got to get them out of there and replace them with some unknown. And I don't mean unknown as in we don't never heard of them. Unfortunately, most of these sleazebags we have heard of, every single one. We wish we hadn't never heard of them, but we have heard of them. But they're unknown in the sense of, well, what are they going to do? Well, actually, I guess we know that, too, because it's the same thing. The same interests get what they want. You don't get what you want. And I mean you. I mean everybody. I mean, the lefties, the commies that are out there that are supporting whoever they're supporting in the Team D primaries. Do you think if anybody on that stage gets elected commies, you're going to get what you want? You really think you're going to get your universal health care and the pharmaceutical companies are going to get cut out of the deal? I'm sorry. Do you really believe that's going to happen? It doesn't matter which one of those. It doesn't matter what great commie lines they spew up there. With the exception of Bernie, Mike would do it. That's why they're going to muscle him out of the nomination, because it's a rigged game. It's the way the game works. See, they don't care who you vote for. People always talk, I've said this many times before, people are always all this time when the election comes around, there's all this voter fraud. You don't understand. They don't need to voter fraud. I mean, I'm not saying they don't do that, but it's not a necessary element for what they do. It's not, because they handpick who your nominee is going to be. So when it comes down to the general election, they don't really give a shit who you vote for, because you're getting their handpicked candidate A or their handpicked candidate B. I think Trump, for credit due, was kind of not necessarily a handpicked candidate. But even then, the fail safes have worked, hasn't it? Everything, you know, back when he did actually seem to be trying to do stuff. I mean, the courts were there, then this is the wide ranging, quote unquote, deep state. The courts were there to thwart him at every turn. The bureaucrats that are there, that have been ensconced in there for years. Isn't it funny? Government bureaucrats, you know, you hear about the deep state. You have these government bureaucrats that have been there for 20 years. How come government workers don't get fired every 2 years? Only their bosses. This is supposed to bring stability. This is supposed to bring a good thing. You wonder why you have such an idea as a deep state, being all of these bureaucrats have ensconced themselves there now, and they've accumulated their little fiefdoms over the years, and they've been there, and they've got their little control powers, and it doesn't matter who's the president or who's in Congress, they've got their little thing, and they run their power. And you wonder why that is. Why would the deep state have power? Well, because the people that are supposed to be in charge keep swapping them out. You keep swapping them out every couple of years. It's a system of built-in instability. It's supposed to make sure. Again, it's a feature. It's not a bug. But everybody thinks it's the opposite. It would be funny in a way. Like, say, if you got an Elizabeth Warren that's been promising the moon to all these commies. It'd be funny in a way to watch her get elected, because you're going to have all these commies that supported her. And they're going to be like the people that actually believed everything Trump promised, you know, on the other side of that thing. You just see this huge letdown when, like, 3 years later, they're like, well, where's my universal health care? Where's my cheap and affordable prescription drugs? Well, sorry, I couldn't make that happen yet. We're still working on that. But we did. There is good things out there. We've really clamped down on Iran, and we continue to give billions of dollars to Israel. The commies are going to be like, what? What? Oh, and we passed some more laws outlawing, you know, this whole divest from Israel movement, because that could be terrorism. You're like, well, I'm a commie and I voted for you, Pocahontas. I thought you were going to do the... thought you were going to do the same. And we're just getting the same end results. There's some details that are different here and there as window dressing, but in the end, you get the same result. I think it's absolutely ludicrous. It really is. The whole thing, the whole system. And people just know what they know. People know what's been there the whole life. So you got people that have lived their whole life under these systems, whether it's the, you know, I just say the voting system, because I'm not even talking America centric here. You can go to any Western European country and it's the same, same clown show, just a little different, a little slightly different in their routines, but same clowns, different show. And anyway, but yeah, no, it's, people have just, they've lived their whole lives under the clown system, and they don't know any other way. And they're scared to death, to even imagine something different. Even like historically speaking, the systems that we live under the West, or this voting system is historically speaking is a new thing, and obviously a temporary thing. Yeah, I mean, it's not going to hold up. But people can't imagine, they can't dare even imagine anything different. So when you suggest something different, it scares them to death. And you can see how this inflexibility of being able to imagine something different makes people easier to control. People are disgusting with the vote. You look at these polls, actual polls that aren't lying, and like, you know, I think Congress's trustworthy rating is at something like 6%. Seven, you know, they go, oh, Trump's rating has fallen below 50%. And then you look at media is like 3%. Congress is like 6%. Now, how do you have a major branch of your government is held in single digit status as far as trustability? Is that word? Trustability? As far as being trustworthy. As far as being trustworthy. There's single digit trustworthy numbers, and yet the system rolls on. Why? I mean, we're seeing faith and confidence in the system collapsing now just because things are getting so clownish. But why do things have to get this clownish? Why can people not just simply look at the fact that they're not getting the results they get, no matter how hard they vote? They're not getting the results that they're promised. They're not getting the results that they want. And the only answer they get why that's not happening is because it's your fault. You're voting for the wrong people or something. Because why have the people not lost faith sooner? And the answer is simple. They can't imagine anything different. They can't imagine anything different. That's why I get the same reaction. People ask me, well, what do you think, Lampshade? You probably just want to recreate the Third Reich or something. No, I've had the same position. I've been so consistent in this position over the years that it's not even funny. My belief is that we can, like, basically build something new. And yes, I think we could incorporate some National Socialist principles, and I'm not going to sit here and start grinding through those. We've gone through it, you know, before, but there are principles of National Socialism once you get past the knee-jerk reaction of the Holocaust and actually look at the principles of the system itself. And there are National Socialists. I mean, hardcore National Socialists that you talk to, you know, that are serious, like, you know, movement serious, aren't talking about trying to recreate the Third Reich. They're just talking about implementing that type of government system, which does not automatically equal the Holocaust and 6 million. It's just a system of government. One of the things that drives me crazy is how people, again, are controlled by the narratives. Even if you take the Holocaust at face value, communism is responsible for far more, you know, ethnic cleansing, far much more genocide. Even if you believe the Holocaust story 100%, you know, the 6 million, you know, the whole nine yards, pedal powered skull smashing machines, roller coasters into the ovens, fake shower gas chambers, the whole nine yards. You believe all of that? That just give you that. Even that, communism is responsible for far more genocide than National Socialism. But yet, if you're in America today and you're a college professor and you proudly let everybody around you know that you're a communist, no problem. You probably probably get you on the fast track to tenure. But if you let them know that, you know, you're open to National Socialist ideas, but you're on the fast track to the unemployment line. Why is that? Why? Because it's not because, it can't be because of the Holocaust, because we've already established that numerically speaking, communism is responsible for far more deaths, far more murders, far more genocide than National Socialism ever was. So it can't be that. Why? That's question. This question for you to ponder and think about. I will just say this. And again, I never, you know, again, I'm not sitting here saying you could recreate the Third Reich. It's a different time, different people, different circumstance. Again, the guys that founded the U.S. came up with a new thing. And they were like, this ought to last 20 years or so. They came up with a new thing. Why do we have no confidence in ourselves that we can't come up with a new thing? Well, what we could do is go back and try the same thing again over and over, try to recreate something from the same blueprint. I think we could come up with something new, but we need to be open to actual ideas. You know, how could we implement things in a manner? You know, people have pointed out that, like, for instance, I mean, like, you look at communist countries even today, like China. China is not the communist country of Mao. I'm not sitting here praising China as a great example. I'm just pointing out that it's something, what they're doing is something different. It started out as Mao communism, yes, you know, it's, but it's not Bolshevik communism from the Soviet Union. It's not. There's been some morphing going on over the decades. And it's something different. It's far more nationalist now. And it is. It's actually something different. If you take modern China, communism, regardless of the name, and compare it to like Stalin's Soviet Union, there's no comparison. It's just there's not. Same thing with North Korea. I watch enough Korean dramas to know that, yeah, it's a communist country, but he runs it like a Korean king from the 1500s. He runs it like a Joseon era king. He is the king. You know, he has advisors around him and they, you know, they have power. They have purges to where people don't gain too much power. He runs the country like their ancient kings ran the country. It's communist, quote unquote. But again, it's not Stalin's Russia. It's not Stalin's Soviet Union. It's not Lenin communism. He runs it like a Korean king. He runs it like their country was run for hundreds of years. They just call it something different. That's why I always tell people, don't get hung up on whatever gets built after Clown World collapse. Don't get hung up on the name. You know, what are we going to call it? Doesn't matter. What matters is it going to be a functioning system that actually serves the needs of the people? Because that's what matters. What matters isn't the name. What matters isn't what kind of flag you fly on your pole. What matters is, do you get a nationalist system that supports the needs of the people themselves? It actually seems to care about the people themselves. And instead of treating the people like a corporate commodity, and you could just swap these people out with third world people, and it's the same difference. A system where, you know, instead of constantly pushing for this number, this GDP growth, being happy with a stable economy and real economic gain being measured in the form of the standard of living of the people. Gross domestic product. Oh, our economy's doing so good. Look, the gross domestic product. That just basically means the corporations are doing better. Nobody gives a shit how the working man on the street is doing, do they? Wouldn't it be nice if economic prosperity wasn't some ever-growing number? Because that's not realistically possible, by the way. That's why another reason why the entire system is doomed. They act like this constant growth has to be achieved. Well, you can't have infinity growth. It's not realistic. And when you add that onto the fact that their entire economic system is based on debt, subject for another day, it's not. You can't have constant growth. A more honorable system, a realistic non-clown world path forward system would be a stable economy where economic growth wasn't, well, is Wall Street getting richer, but instead is the standard of living of the people getting any better. But we have the opposite. Like everything else, everything's bizarro world. We have the opposite. That's why these corporations, they support all of this mass migration. They want, everything is done to keep the labor pool flooded and the labor, the wages low. Everything is designed so that Wall Street gets richer, but the people, your wages stay stagnant forever. In fact, now you have to work two jobs. Congratulations. Because we can't have that. If GDP would go down, if these companies were forced to pay more money to their employees, we've got to keep these companies flourishing. The company's not the nation. The people are supposed to be the nation. That's the way it's supposed to be. The people are the nation. Not megacorp corporation. Not Wall Street. Not Shekel Brothers mega bank. It's supposed to be the people. The whole point of having a nation is to better the lives of the people. But that's not what you get in Clown World. In Clown World, the people are there to serve the corporations, to serve the big banks. You're just livestock. It's all a mess. And that whole, and again, getting back to the subject at hand, because I kind of, we wandered with this topic. The whole notion that you take and get rid of people who are competent. Oh, sorry, you're set amount of time is up, we're going to throw you out and replace you with somebody else. It's just utter ridiculousness. And I thought the whole kvetching over Putin staying in power was a great example of this. Oh, we can't have this guy staying in power. Why? Is he not doing a great job? Well, that doesn't matter. My principles is that, you know, you got to keep replacing them with worse and worse people every year. That, my friends, is progress. We'll wrap up on that note and get into our sermon this week in the Church of the Lampshade. Hope you enjoyed that part. Those of you who don't hang around, I think everybody hangs around. I think even hardcore atheists now hang around for the Church of the Lampshade. Who wouldn't? But anyway, get on in here, fill those pews. I've already got the official Church of the Lampshade wear on right here. Got my crazy Old West preacher frock coat. Been wandering around in the desert. The desert of clown world. And and it's driven me half insane. So now, yeah, and I'll get on in here. We'll see what kind of insanity we can cover in this week's insane Christian-specific message. We're going to do it, like I said, at the beginning of the show. We're doing something a little different this week. We're rocking Old Testament. Always a little hard sometimes because people get hung up. As soon as you get in the Old Testament, people fall into the same trap as the modern cuck church. Once you start saying Israel, and they're like, it's the same Israel as today. If I got rich and bought a ranch and named my ranch Israel, and my cattle brand is a Star of David, would that make me Abraham? Of course, you'd be like, no, you retard. Why would you even think that? And yet, the modern cuck church is, you know, it's the same name. It's the same Israel. Jesus was specific about what makes you a child of Abraham. Abraham had faith, and his faith was credited as righteousness. Boom, children of Abraham. Again, God can make children of Abraham out of these rocks. My chosen people. So, yeah, I assume that Lampshade listeners are beyond that. I do. I think I've got faith. I've got confidence that we can do Old Testament and you won't get hung up on Israel. Grandpa Lampshade, you're talking about Israel. You just might as well. Are you talking about King David? Or are you talking about Netanyahu? The idea that God would choose Abraham when Abraham was like the first, very first original caricature of a happy merchant, you know, like, oh God, how can I, you know, and you read about it, and that's not how Abraham was. I mean, Abraham like cared about people and was like worried about people. And like when God was like, we're going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and Abraham's like, well, what if there's 10 decent people there? I mean, they're going to die. You know, what about those people? You know, I mean, that was the kind of guy. Yeah. So anyway, we're not going to get off on that, but we are going to talk about King David, and a story that most of y'all are probably familiar about, the beginning of David's problems as a king, the whole incident, you know what I'm talking about, Bathsheba, where King David gave in to the demonic urge, and all of his problems in his reign, everything had been pretty much rocking along smooth here. And most of y'all probably pretty familiar with the story, but there's aspects of it that I thought we're going to go through this, you know, the first, you know, main part of this this story in the Old Testament, because there's aspects of it that, you know, this was it wasn't just the one thing he did that pissed God off. There was a multi-step process of what he did that really, really angered God here, and we're going to get into this and reflect on this a little bit, because one of the great things about the Old Testament is it's a reflection. It's several things. There's several aspects of the Old Testament. One is so much of it is how to set up a government, you know, how to set up a justice system, things such as this that aren't covered in there. That's why people think there's a contradiction between, quote unquote, turn the other cheek. That's a whole nother discussion we've had multiple times. And an eye for an eye. Well, one is a justice system, and one is conducting your personal behavior with the people around you, and not necessarily always just going off over my disrespect, you know, but having some self-control. But if you ran a justice system on, well, we're not going to throw anybody in prison because we're turning the other cheek, your entire society wouldn't last a day. It would collapse into anarchy, chaos. So, but the other aspect, which is kind of what we're getting into today, of the Old Testament it serves as an illustration of God's relationship with man, of how God relates with man, of the thing. And in this story here, the things, you know, that men do that and why it is that those things, these sins that men do, piss God off. And it's an important thing to understand because we're all apt to sin. Every single one of us, we're all failed human beings. We're all subject and open to the possibility of sin. And it's a funny thing because we tend to think of sin being, you know, temptation being more of when you're struggling. You know, a poor person, a person who's starving is going to be tempted to steal. I ain't gonna lie. If I was, I hadn't eaten in 3 days and I'm homeless on the street, I'm going to walk into a restaurant and eat their shit and then tell them, call the police. I got no money. I'll go to jail and eat their food. You know, I mean, I'm not going to starve to death. So you can't hardly hold it against somebody starving to death. We think of being tempted to sin so often as being something that happens when we're down on our luck, when we're poor. We tell, you know, it's like the crime thing. It's poverty that causes crime. It's poverty. We kind of get this impression that, you know, being poor, having hard times is what leads us to sin. And yet we look around our society today and the absolute most corrupt people are the very wealthy. And this strikes us as strange, doesn't it? When we hear these Pizzagate rumors about these powerful and wealthy people, and, you know, they're probably kitty diddlers, and they do all this weird, corrupt, horrible, wicked things, and it seems amazing to those of us who, like, just live check to check, week to week, keep food on the table, keep the lights on. Those of us who $200 is a lot of money. These people that have billions, that have more money than they could spend their entire life, and yet they're partaking in all of this absolute satanic, weirdo, over-the-edge, lunatic-level wickedness. And it seems amazing to us, doesn't it? It's like, you've got all this money, and you got to do that. But that is where the more wealth you have, more prosperity you have, more temptation, so often than not. This is where sin comes in, where you really get tempted. And this was the case for King David. David, early on in his rise to power, you know, he's a popular warrior. Saul was the king, and it's worth going back and reading on your own. When David was running around, Saul was king, because it's so obvious that King Saul was literally insane. I mean, the man was nuts. He had something wrong with him in his head. He was crazy, because one minute he would be like, oh man, y'all are great. I love you guys. And then, like, literally a split second later, something would set him off and he would grab a spear and try to kill people. And he'd just try to kill everybody around him. He was insane. The man was literally insane. And David had this guy constantly trying to kill him, but he even though he had the opportunity to kill Saul, he wouldn't do it because God told him, you know, not to do that, that you can't do that. And so he bent over backwards, running around, staying alive, him and his band of warriors fighting and doing what they could and this and that. And half the time they were helping Saul out because they were defending their people and Saul was the king. And then the other half of the time they were running around trying to keep Saul from killing him. It was a really trying time, and yet he held his faith and he did well. And eventually Saul died. It's again, that's all, the whole story's worth reading. It's not what we're covering today, but, and David rises to power. He goes through this horrible, this very trying time, and manages now he's been in power. His kingdom secured, and he's got prosperity. And you see, this is when the temptation to sin. He held the temptation. I don't know how, because if somebody's trying to kill me, like if you got somebody literally going around trying to kill you, I get the opportunity, I'm gonna kill him back. Yeah, we've got to kill them before they can kill you. Anybody would do that. You know, I mean, I think that's human nature. And yet he withstood that because God had said, no, you can't kill the king. He withstood that temptation, but now he's the king. Now he's got all of this prosperity. Life is easy. And now the temptation comes. Now the temptation comes, and it's a multi-layered temptation, and the way he handles it goes from bad to worse. And it's worth going over because it's a good illustration of the things that make God angry. So we're looking in 2 Samuel. We're going to start at chapter 11. And it came to pass, after the year was expired, at the time when kings go forth to battle, that David sent, and I won't get these names right, just rock with me on it. Don't be like, that's not pronounced that way, Lampshade. I do my best. Anyway, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the children of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David tarried still in Jerusalem. So he sent the troops out. They're having good luck on battle. He's still hanging out. He's hanging out back at the capital, living good, living large. And it came to pass in an evening tide that David arose from off his bed and walked upon the roof of the king's house. And from the roof he saw a woman washing herself. And the woman was very beautiful to look upon. My dick. I got the money. I'm going to get the hose. He's got... So, yeah. And you have to remember, I mean, the king has absolute power. You know, I mean, the king has pretty much free reign. You know, he can do what he wants. So he's sitting there. He's got up, stretched out. His troops are off, having good luck in battle. And he wanders around the roof and looks down and looks at this good-looking woman. And David sent and inquired after the woman. And one said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Okay, so stop here for a minute. So he inquires, who's this good-looking gal? Because the king can have any woman he wants. So he's like, man. He woke up in one of those moods. And the first thing he sees when he looks down is his good-looking gal down there washing herself. Okay, well, you know. So, hey, who is this gal? And people, you know, her? This guy's wife. That should have been the stopping point. He should have been like, oh, don't want to get near that. But he's the king. And the king can have anything he wants. The ultimate in prosperity, not only do you have money, but you just give the word and people do what you say. And David sent messengers. So did David say, whoa, that's somebody's old lady? I know that guy. That's his old lady? I didn't know that. Wow, he did pretty well for himself, and leave it at that. No, he did not. And David sent and inquired. Let's see here. And David sent messengers and took her. And she came in unto him, and he lay with her. For she was purified from her uncleanness, and she returned unto her home. He hit it. Okay, here's first thing. He gets up. Looks lustfully upon this woman is step one. It's not a bad thing. It's not too bad. He could have stopped there, but he didn't. Next step, who is this gal? Oh, that's Uriah the Hittite's old lady. That's his wife. Could have stopped there. Could have said, no, okay, we'll keep this between. I didn't even ask who that was. I just, you know, I got it there. This is the guy who resisted the temptation to kill Saul when Saul was trying to kill him. But now, can't resist in his prosperity the temptation to have this woman. Knows it's another man's wife. So he gives the word, brings her to it. And again, you have to keep in context, the king's word is absolute. She didn't get a choice in the matter. You know, I mean, you know, I don't know, doesn't say what her reaction was to it. She might have been thrilled. She got to lay with the king. I don't know. It's irrelevant. What is relevant is the fact that he chose to do this now. He gave the word. He didn't say, oh, that's his old lady. I'm going to stay away from that. No, he gives the word. Brings her in and bangs her. So let's say they bang for a solid hour and it's the best he's ever had. As we'll see, it's not worth it. Don't care how good it was. It wasn't worth it. Another thing worth noting here is King David, he's the king. This isn't a case of, yeah, you know, it's easy to get hung up on the lust part of it. But it's not a matter of, I mean, King David was not having a problem getting laid. I'm going to just, we lay it out. Y'all know how it is here in the Church of Lampshade. We lay it out here. This ain't modern cut church where we try to be all polite when, and in so doing, we can't say what needs to be said because we've got to be polite. We're going to say what needs to be said. King David was not having a problem getting laid. He probably had like 500 wives at this time. King David could go down and go through the marketplace or whatever and find a beautiful, young, virgin, teenage girl, the prettiest thing you could find, and say, hey, I want you to be my wife. And her parents would be like, oh my gosh, we have hit the lottery. Our daughter is going to be one of the king's three. She's going to be the king's 351st wife. Yes, we have scored. Yes. He could have any woman he wanted in the kingdom. He's a king. You go down and say, hey, you know. So this isn't a case of David was sitting around sex starved. I mean, he had his choice of basically any woman in the kingdom. So this isn't just about the lust. It's about so full of himself, so full of his own power. It wasn't just getting laid. It was the fact that he could bang this guy. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. This is even this guy's wife. And all I got to do is give the word. And she's in here and them panties are on the floor. That's power. Ooh, that's something you get. That is what was really exciting about it. Wasn't the sex. He'd have sex anytime he wanted to. It was that power. The real pleasure for him out of this was that power. This is Uriah the Hittite's wife. Give the word, tell that bitch to get up here and get them panties off. And she's up there to do, okay. That is the temptation. Not to say he'd get sex anytime. So let's continue here. Where are we at? Oh, yeah. Verse 5 looks like. Okay, so he bangs her out, sends her home. Sends her on to the house. Everything's good. And the woman conceived and sent and told David and said, I am with child. Guess what, King David? You are the baby daddy. You see, he went, he hit that, he's all high on the power, banged one of his loyal followers' wives. But, sent her home. Figured that was fun. But now she got a baby. And guess what? Her husband's been off in battle. So there ain't going to be none of this, oh, it's yours, honey. Yeah. Military wives of being military wives, isn't it? I've been in Iraq for, 6 months. You come home and your wife is like 4 months pregnant. It's a miracle. Okay. Nobody falling for that. Now she's knocked up and her husband's been off in battle. Things are already starting to get sticky. David's starting to get into a bigger and bigger mess. So what does he do? And David sent to Joab saying, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent Uriah to David. So he sends the woman's husband back from the battlefield. And when Uriah was come unto him, David demanded of him how Joab did and how the people did and how the war prospered. So he acted like he wanted him sent back as like a report. Come back and give me a message. I called you in here. It's a lie. His messengers. He knows how the war is progressing. This is a lie. He lied and made it like, I just wanted you here to find out how's this guy really doing? I can't ask him. He's going to tell me everything's great. You tell me you're really important. You're a great guy. I trust you. I don't even necessarily trust your commander, but I'm going to trust you to tell me how's it really going? How's the war really progressing? It's a lie. It's fake pretense. And David, here comes what the real idea is. And David said to Uriah, go down to thy house and wash thy feet. And Uriah departed out of the king's house, and there followed him a mess of meat from the king. Do you see what he's doing here? He says, go to your house and wash your feet. This guy's been off in the battlefield for however long. He's back. He says, go on home, wash your feet. Go home, clean up, relax. The guy's been off in the battlefield. He figures, so he sends a load of meat with him too. He says, here's a good meal. Go home. You've done such a good job. Go home. Have a good meal. Clean yourself up. Relax. You've been in the battlefield for how long? David's reaction to this is literally, he's trying to cuck Uriah the Hittite. That's literally what he's doing here. This is the next thing I believe that really pisses God off. It's this multi-step thing. This is one of the, he crossed a major line by banging her out. we use language here, but this is he did this. He went and crossed that line with that, and this was a great sin, yes. But it gets worse. I think because as we go through this, it's progressively getting worse what he's done to anger God. He was told this was another man's wife. He didn't stop there. That made God mad. You know, it's just like when people piss you off, it's usually very seldom like one thing. It's like they collectively piss you off. You know, they do this and then they do this. And then it just keeps building. And it seems like they keep doing something that's worse. You know, he didn't pass when he found out it was this guy's old lady. And then he takes the next step. He bangs her out. That's bad. And now, even worse, I think, because every step he takes, things get worse. He literally decides to cuck Uriah the Hittite. He wants him to go home. He figures he's been on the battlefield. I'm sending him a bunch of meat, probably some booze with it. He's going to wash himself. Of course, first thing he's going to do is he's going to bang her. And then, oh, well, the date of conception will be close enough that it will be within plausible deniability that you are the daddy. He's trying to cuck Uriah the Hittite. This is a very evil thing, a very wicked thing. But Uriah didn't do it. Foil David's plan. But Uriah slept at the door of the king's house with all the servants of his lord and went not down to his house. It didn't work. He wanted to cuck Uriah the Hittite and it didn't work. And when they had told David, saying, Uriah went not down unto his house, David sent unto to Uriah, Camest thou not from thy journey? Why then didst thou not go down unto thine house? And Uriah said unto David, The ark and Israel and Judah abide in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are encamped in the open field. Shall I then go into mine house to eat and to drink and to lie with my wife? As thou livest and as thou soul liveth, I will not do this thing. So Uriah is like, he came from the battlefield. And he's like, look, my commanding officers, my brothers that I've been out here fighting shoulder to shoulder with, they're out here living in tents on the battlefield. And you're telling me I should go home? This is an honorable response. Uriah is like, I ain't going home to eat, drink, relax, lay with my wife. My brothers are out there. My brothers are out there sleeping in a tent on the ground. My brothers are out there shedding blood and getting killed, and I don't even know how they're doing. And you're telling me, oh, just go back and kick back and relax? I think Uriah was probably taken back that David would expect such a thing of him instead of assigning him the honorable attitude of a warrior. But see, David's reaction was, hey, you're going to give this guy the opportunity. You could go kick back. You get the opportunity. He's going to go home, live at large as long as he can before he has to go back to the battlefield. But this guy was a man of honor. He said, no, man, my brothers are out there. My brothers are out there living in a tent, sleeping on the ground. You tell me, go kick back and take it easy. My commanding officer, whom I respect and admire, is out there sleeping in a tent. He ain't got no women with him. And me, I'm not going to do this thing. And David said to Uriah, tarry here today also and tomorrow. I will let thee depart. So Uriah abode in Jerusalem that day and the morrow. And when David had called him, he did eat and drink before him, and he made him drunk. And at even he went out to lie on his bed with the servants of the Lord, but went not down to his house. So David had him hang out, got him drunk. I'll get him drunk. He'll go home. He's going to get a little booze in him, and he's going to forget all of that honor thing. See, David is now acting like, mimicking the actions of the devil, isn't he? I'll get him drunk and then get him to abandon his honor and go home. Doesn't matter. It's not dishonorable that, you know, he would wind up having sex with his wife. It would be dishonorable because he's standing on principle, a man of principle. I'm not, while my brothers are out here, I'm not going to be up here laying, you know, no, I'm not going to do that. I can't do that. I'll sleep on the ground just like my brothers are until I go back to the battlefield. But David's trying to get him to discard his honor. He's trying to get him to fold on the, I'll get him drunk and then he'll give in. I wonder what it must have felt like for David
if he was self-reflecting at the moment, to see this man with such honor that he wouldn't go lay with his own wife because of his principles, because of his solidarity with his brothers who are out on the battlefield. And here he is lounging around the castle and banged the guy's wife out. Another man's wife. That must have really, really rubbed him the wrong way. And it came to pass in the morning that David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. Things are going downhill at this point. And he wrote in the letter saying, "Set ye Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle and retire ye from him that he may be smitten and die." He knew the guy had so much honor that he wouldn't read the letter. He knew he wrote the letter, said, "Deliver this to your commanding officer." I mean, the guy could have peeked, but he knew he wouldn't. He was a man of honor. He made this man of honor carry his own death warrant. And he was innocent. He hadn't done anything wrong. He had acted with honor through this whole thing. And he's making him carry his own death warrant. Just because David wants to hide what he's done. He tried to cuck Uriah the Hittite. That didn't work. So you can see where this is progressively getting worse. The adultery, the having sex with the man's wife was bad enough. The next step of worseness is he tries to cuck Uriah the Hittite. Now he's taking a man of honor and making him carry his own death warrant. A innocent man who's done nothing wrong, he's making him carry his death warrant. He's making him pay the price for David's sin. Think about that. He is making Uriah the Hittite. Why is he losing his life? He hadn't done nothing wrong. David's the one that did something wrong. But he's the one who's going to bear the brunt. He's the one who's going to pay the price for David's indiscretions. And it came to pass when Joab observed the city that he assigned Uriah unto a place where he knew that valiant men were. And the men of the city went out and fought with Joab, and there fell some of the people, the servants of David, and Uriah the Hittite died also. So now he's had Uriah murdered. We talk about, you don't have to get your own hands dirty to be a murderer. You know, that's why we have laws in this country. If you hire a hitman and the hitman, you pay the hitman and he goes out and murders somebody and it gets discovered, I mean, you don't get off scot-free. You're going to be tried for murder just like the hitman because you plotted it. You came up with the idea. Just because you technically didn't do it yourself, you're murdered. Thinking about, how our own government, has gone out, like assassinated this general from Iran, and that makes them literally like murderers. This guy was driving along in a car and, they had somebody else do it, but it still makes them murderers. But everybody cheers along. We're not going to get off on that discussion. We're already past our hour here, so we got to keep rocking along. Then Joab sent and told David all the things concerning the war, and charged the messenger, saying, "When thou hast made an end of telling the matters of the war unto the king, and if so be that the king's wrath arise, and he say unto thee, 'Wherefore approached ye so nigh unto the city when ye did fight? Knew ye not that they would shoot from the wall? Who smote Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, did not a woman cast a piece of millstone upon him from the wall, and he died in Tebez? Why went ye nigh to the wall? Then say thou, thy servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also." So he knows David's going to be like, "Why did y'all attack this way? You knew they were going to drop stuff off the wall. Why would you attack the wall?" And he's telling the messenger, "Tell him that Uriah the Hittite's dead too." That'll be the end of that. So the messenger went and came and shewed David all that Joab had sent him for. And the messenger said unto David, "Surely the men prevailed against us,
and came out unto us into the field, and we were upon them even unto the entering of the gate. And the shooters shot from off the wall upon thy servants, and some of the king's servants be dead, and thy servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. So the battle report didn't come back real good. They don't even care about that. All he cares about is Uriah the Hittite dead. Then David said unto the messenger, thus shalt thou say unto Joab, let not this thing displease thee, for the sword devoureth one as well as another. Make thy battle more strong against the city, and overthrow it, and encourage thou him. Man, you've got Uriah the Hittite, who had so much honor that he wouldn't go down. And would his brothers have even blamed if he got back? Man, the king let me go home. I had sex with my wife, took a bath, got meat. They would have been like, oh man, bro, you did good. It wouldn't have even held it against him, but on his own honor, he wouldn't even do those things out of solidarity for his fellow men on the battlefield. His commander on the battlefield. Same commander who set him up to be murdered. Now, you compare that honor, how much he cared for his fellow men on the battlefield, to David. As long as Uriah hit tight steady, he don't care. Ah, tell him, don't worry about it. Yeah, the battle didn't go well. A bunch of guys got killed. Sword devoured everybody. That's the way it works. They're just numbers. They don't even matter. He doesn't even give a shit. Sounds familiar to our corrupt system. They don't care. They give lip service when these guys come back in a box. They don't care. They're just numbers. They don't care. Don't worry about it. He got what he wanted him, or wanted out of it. And when the wife of Uriah heard that Uriah, her husband, was dead, she mourned for her husband. And when the mourning was past, David sent and fetched her to his house, and she became his wife, and bare him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. Problem solved. It progressively got worse. He did the sex thing with Uriah's wife. Then he attempted to cuck Uriah. Now he's murdered Uriah. Now, okay, she's mourning for her husband. As soon as the mourning period is over, he brings her into the castle. He brings her into the palace. You're my next wife. Got to try to keep that conception date within the realm of plausible deniability. We can't have people sitting around going, doing the math, going, wait a minute. We'll just claim it's a little premature. It's a little early. Doesn't even care. Had this guy murdered. And the Lord, so the Lord's not happy. And we're going to wrap up here pretty quick here. And the Lord sent Nathan unto David. And he came unto him and said unto him, there were two men in one city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had exceeding many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing save one little ewe lamb, which he had bought and nourished up, and it grew up together with him and with his children, and it did eat of his own meat and drank of his own cup and lay in his bosom, and was unto him as a daughter. And there came a traveler unto the rich man, and he spared the take of his own flock and of his own herd to dress for the wayfaring man that which come unto him, but took the poor man's lamb and dressed it for the man that was come unto him. And David's anger was greatly kindled against the man, and he said to Nathan, as the Lord liveth, the man that had done this thing shall surely die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity. And Nathan said to David, thou art the man. Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I anointed thee king over Israel, and I delivered thee out of the hand of Saul. And I gave thee thy master's house, and thy master's wives into thy bosom, and gave thee the house of Israel and of Judah. And if that had been too little, I would moreover have given unto thee such and such things. I prepared to give you pretty much whatever you wanted, within reason. Wherefore hast thou despised the commandment of the Lord to do evil in his sight? Thou hast killed Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and hast taken his wife to be thy wife, and hast slain him with the sword of the children of Ammon. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from thine house, because thou hast despised me, and hast taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be thy wife. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house, and I will take thy wives before thine eyes, and give them unto thy neighbor, and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of this sun. For thou didst it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun. Oh, wow. What a mess, huh? He got this far and figured, I'm free. But the Lord was displeased. So when he heard the story, he thought they was telling him about this guy that had all this money and all these sheep and stuff. And he has a visitor come and, oh, we need to slay a lamb. They go and take the poor guy's one little ewe lamb that he's loved his whole life and treated as a pet and slain it to feed the stranger. That made him angry. He still had a bit of righteousness in there. He had just gotten so blinded by sin, by temptation. It sucked him in. That he basically lost himself. We're going to stop here. But this begins, you know, the problems of David's reign. It all starts here. He started with something as seemingly meaningless as getting up in the mood one morning and spotting a beautiful woman. And then the next step, and then the next step, and then the next step. And it just keeps getting worse and worse. And his sin keeps building up, and he keeps building up anger. The Lord points out to you, look, it's not because you had a lack of women. It's not because I gave you everything. I made you king. If this wouldn't have been enough, I would have given you more. I would have given you more wealth, more women. There's your reward. You've done a good job. You persevered through all of this time. You kept the faith all of this time. I'd have given you all of these things, but it wasn't enough. You had to go and do this thing. You had to go scoff me. You had to go disregard me and do this evil. For those of us, which pretty much includes everybody listening to the show, as well as the humble host, for those of us that live normal, working people lives, we just look to get through day by day. You know, we think money, you know, prosperity is the end all answer to everything, because most of our problems center around money, or should I say the lack thereof. And we look upon, when we hear of these rich, corrupt people, when you hear of things like Pizzagate, and you have these unimaginably wealthy, powerful people, and it's like, you hear about things like Pizzagate, and it's like, why would they be like pedophile? Why would they do that? I mean, you're filthy rich. You can have sex with any beautiful woman you want. It's like David here. It's not that. It's the fact that they can. It's the fact that you people are stuck in your little lives, but we're not you. We're up here. We're up above that. We have this power. We're so powerful, we can screw kidnap children and then murder them in a satanic ritual, and nobody's going to do anything. That's what gets them off. It's not the act. It's the fact that they have that power, that they can do those things. It's so easy to focus on our humble circumstances. But in a way, those humble circumstances can be a blessing, because as we've seen here with corrupt people in our world today, and here with David, who up to this point was an upright man, it always strove to do what was the will of the Lord. The more prosperity comes your way, the more the devil comes a-knocking. We tend to think of it opposite. We tend to think that, you know, the more trying times, the more we struggle, things such as that, the more the devil tempts us. And that's not to say he doesn't come around and tempt us. It doesn't mean that we don't have things we struggle with. But the more prosperity you have, then the more the temptation comes around. Even in our humble circumstances, that too could be a blessing. We always hear that God will not let you be tempted more than you can handle. Well, sometimes maybe our humble circumstances are a part of that. Maybe God is blessing us in a way with humble circumstances where we're not tempted beyond what we can handle. Because this is obviously what happened to David. He got tempted. He was in the lap of luxury. He was at the pinnacle of his society. He was the super alpha
at the top of the hierarchy of the entire nation of people. But it didn't matter. That in and of itself was his temptation. And that in and of itself ultimately was his downfall. We're going to wrap up on that note. Hopefully something interesting for you this week, something to ponder and think about. There's interesting things all through the scripture, and it's just interesting stories. And when you think about them in the context of how it mean, what it means to you, how God acts, how God relates with man, even today, and the things that make God angry, and such as that. It's very, very interesting stuff. So we're going to wrap up on that note. Once again, very much appreciate those of you who pay your tithes to the Church of the Lampshade, who support our work here. That information, again, is at the bottom of the page. Highly encourage you to do so. And yeah, we'll wrap up on that note. Don't forget, you can also catch us Friday in our Clown World Interview, a.k.a. Daily Nationalist, where I sit down with Sven Longshanks and discuss something lighthearted. We shoot for 30 minutes. We never make 30 minutes. It's usually about 40. Sven is always like, how come we can't make that? It's like, it's because I'm here and I can't shut up. I just love visiting about these things. So anyway, we'll wrap up on that note. Thank you to our supporters. Thank you to our listeners. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back next week for the Church of the Lampshade.